Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll talk with Cassidy Randall. Her new book, 30 Below, tells the story of a group of female adventurers and their treacherous pioneering ascent of Denali in 1970. Everyone told the Denali Damsels, as the team called themselves, that it couldn't be done. Women were incapable of climbing mountains on their own. Men had walked on the moon. Women still had not stood on the highest points on Earth. But these six women were unwilling to be limited by sexists and misogynists. They pushed past barriers in society at large, the climbing world, and their own bodies. Cassidy Randall is an award-winning writer who tells stories on the environment, adventure, and people who expand human potential. Previous books called The Hard Parts, she wrote with Paralympian Oksana Masters. The new book, again, is called 30 Below, publishes on Tuesday. Cassidy Randall, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you speak to me from Montana, I think?
I am. I'm from Missoula.
Yeah. I don't know. Are you outdoor-oriented? Do you climb? Is that part of why you chose this?
I am outdoor-oriented. It's funny. I actually have a little imposter syndrome in not being an alpinist myself. I know from previous mountain climbing that my body doesn't do well at altitude. So that's not my thing. But I am a backcountry skier. So I ski outside the bounds of ski resorts where you climb up mountains and ski down them. And I dabble in ski mountaineering. And I have been on long expeditions in the wilderness with small groups of people. I have been in situations in the wild where I thought I might die. Also in Alaska in the Brooks Range. And so some of that can translate, right? And I understand the call of mountains. I understand why people would do things that put you at risk like that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that. We'll get into talking about Grace Holman, who led this expedition, the others who went with her. But just in general, the call of the mountain.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Western culture has, for a long time, romanticized mountaineering, right? You think about the first people even who were watching first ascents in the Alps from the valley floor with binoculars to our modern obsession with everything Everest, right? Or things that come out of the Himalaya, those kind of stories, all the big mainstream news wants to cover it. So we have this such a romanticized view of it at the same time that I think a lot of people who have never spent time in the wilderness or in the mountains wonder why would people want to suffer, you know, for days on end? Why would you risk your bodies, your lives, sometimes losing your loved ones? What's the point, right? And there's so many different reasons. I think for a lot of people, it's this idea, obviously, of challenging themselves. And I think it goes beyond that. A lot of people love this feeling of ultimate presence that you can have when you are in these situations where with mountaineering, for example, all you have to do is to get up, sustain yourself, keep moving forward and upward, right? The simplicity of that is just so appealing. But also when you are in situations where there is a little bit of risk, you are ultimately present. And it's the kind of presence that some people meditate, you know, for hours, for lifetimes to achieve, right? And that coming back into, you know, the quote unquote real world after that, so many people who've experienced those feelings in the wild, that feeling of grace, of ultimate presence, of challenging yourself, of seeing the awe that transcends the feeling of time and self. So many people will sacrifice everything to get back to that, right? That's why you have career mountaineers and career whitewater kayakers and all of that.
So mountaineering, at least the, I guess the highest peaks for, I guess, decades, this was problems of men, right?
Right. Yeah. So women, which I think is so interesting when, I mean, 1970 is still very modern history, right? It's not that long ago. And it is shocking to me that women still hadn't stood on the highest 7,000, 8,000 meter points on Earth by that time. A couple women had stood on top of Denali. You and I were talking about this earlier, Barbara Washburn, who was the wife of Bradford Washburn, who was this pioneering cartographer, mountaineer. He was the first to fully map the enormity of Denali with photos and cartography. And she went up with him in 1947, was the first woman to stand on top of it and had to be convinced to do it because this company, RKO Pictures, was making a film and they thought that having a woman would be so appealing. But she had three little kids at home And that was a big reason you didn't see a lot of women in these long expeditions at the time, right? Because motherhood, traditional motherhood, did not allow for being gone for a month at a time from your children, right? So they hire a nanny. She makes it all the way to the top. She has a great time, but she doesn't say that she did it for anything other than because she wanted to be with her husband, which is really interesting. Another woman had stood on top, Honora Bucknell, and she had done a different kind of a pretty demanding ascent. And she's called it a wonderful experience and not much more than that. So I think what's interesting in terms of having women's thoughts about mountains before, you know, even 1970, is that a lot of women, one, just didn't participate, or two, their voices weren't necessarily ones that anyone wanted to hear at the time. So
I'm looking at a picture of Elizabeth LeBond in the book. She's obviously, climbing in snow. But her attire is such that you could have been walking down the street in London.
Right. Right?
She's in a skirt, very proper attire. I guess that's what you were expected to do. And yet she scandalized society because she wasn't accompanied by a male relative.
Exactly. Yeah. So there were a couple of reasons that Elizabeth LeBlanc talked about that were very clear ones why there weren't a lot of women in the mountains. So she was climbing around the turn of the 20th century, right? In the late 1800s, early 1900s. And she would climb in the Alps with her male guides without having her brother or a husband or her father present, which was just something you were absolutely not supposed to do. You were not supposed to be unchaperoned, right? Without a male relative, let alone in the wild heights where anything could happen. But she also, yeah, women at the time were expected to climb in these heavy skirts. And imagine trying to climb mountains that are often covered in snow with wet skirts tangling around your ankles. And so she would often just shuck her skirt once she was out of sight of huts or towns, and she would leave them behind rocks or wherever she could kind of hide them, climb in her knickers, which were these bloomer-like underthings for women, come back, put her skirt on. And there is this great anecdote where once an avalanche had carried away her skirt while she was climbing, and when she came back, it had vanished. And she has to head back to town and just her bloomers and hide behind a tree while her male guide goes to her hotel room to find her something to wear. And he comes back carrying an evening gown, thinking that's acceptable.
So typical, right? You just imagine this conversation. What? It's an evening gown. It's something to wear. She's probably disappointed in it. Let's have you tell us about Grace Holman, her background. She's the leader of this expedition, 1970.
Yes.
And a fascinating, fascinating story. Born in the U.S., but her Dutch mother takes her Nazi times, right, to back to Holland. She ends up going to medical school, I think, in Berlin in the middle of the Nazi regime. Tell me a little bit about Grace Holman.
Oh, I think that Grace is so fascinating, and I could have written a whole book just on Grace Holman. So her mother ends up taking her back to Holland and raises Grace there, and her Grace's stepfather ends up being the one who introduces Grace to mountains and skiing and all of that. And by the time Grace is 21 years old, this is so also indicative of what kind of woman Grace was. She wanted to be a doctor, and she went to Berlin in 1942 in the heart of World War II to go to the university there because it was the best one to get a medical degree. By the time she was 21, she'd fallen in love with another doctor, had their first daughter. That doctor was shot in combat, killed while she's pregnant with their second daughter. And she's widowed, right? Again, just in the heart of wartime Nazi Berlin. So she finishes out her medical degree pregnant with her two-year-old daughter. And once she's given birth to her second daughter, finished out her degree, Grace's mom hops on a bike from Holland, cycles into Berlin, finds a bike for Grace, and they cycle the two little girls out of Germany. Like, just amazing. I mean, you could write so much about that. But so she really wanted to become a surgeon. And she thought that there would be more opportunities in the US for that, because she was finding that in Europe, women were being shunted into OBGYN obstetrics if there was any medical sort of avenue for them whatsoever. I mean, this is a time when less than 10% of women are doctors, probably far less than that. So she goes to school, goes to get a postdoc in on the East Coast of the States, leaves her daughters with her mom. So kind of eschews traditional mothering at a time when that also was very frowned upon. And basically gets shut out of the medical community there as well. She finally like lands in Alaska as an anesthesiologist, because that was the only way she could get into the operating room, right? To still be part of things. Lands in Alaska and there reconnects with these huge mountains that just she falls absolutely in love with. And she starts mountaineering alone because she doesn't know anyone, which is pretty incredible. I mean, the Alaskan wild is not, you know, a forgiving place, but this is how capable this woman is. And she, in 1967, is on this expedition to the top of Denali via a very difficult route. She's the only woman. She's the team doctor, as she often was for mountaineering expeditions. And she gets turned back on this expedition to the top of Denali. She's never been on Denali. She's never been to the top. She desperately wants to get there. She gets turned back halfway up by the expedition leader. She suspects because she is a woman, it's also because she's suffering from altitude sickness, which she refuses to admit to herself because that's a weakness and she can't admit weakness. And there ends up being this massive storm that is still the most tragic event to ever happen in Denali's history, where seven men were engulfed in this storm on the top. And the Grace's expedition leader knew that. A doctor might have come in very handy. He turns her back anyway. And all those seven men end up dying. Grace's husband, who is also an Alaskan mountaineer named Ben Homan, organizes this humanitarian expedition to the top to find the bodies of those men, brings Grace along, turns Grace back again halfway because she's suffering from altitude sickness. But again, Grace also, and you know, it could be very true that it was because she was a woman. Like you think about the popular narrative at the time that women weren't supposed to be able to do this, right? It was just too hard. So Grace ends up having this chip on her shoulder that she has never made it to the top of Denali. And if she tries again a third time and doesn't make it, she will never be invited on these expeditions to the Great Mountains in the Himalaya. She'll never be allowed to try Denali again. The park won't issue her a permit. So she has these really big stakes of proving herself this third time that she is going up Denali and leading this group of women in 1970.
Tell me a little bit more about the sexism, these attitudes toward women. Certainly manifests itself on the 67, you know, climb. The other women we'll talk about experience this as well. I'm going to read this from the book. The presence of a woman would be unpleasant high on the open ice. Let's talk about Arlene Blum. We'll talk about not only in excretory situations, but in easy masculine companionship of the heights. We don't want a woman there because it'll disrupt our boys' club, I guess, right? That's one thing. Women were too weak, right?
Oh, yeah.
For example, the 67 climb, Grace Homan was carrying a pack that was 10 pounds lighter, I think. The men didn't let her forget that, right? tell me a little bit more about that. There were another thing I was reading. If a woman were to, you know, summit this whatever mountain it was, well, then cross it off our list. It's too easy. It's not worth anything.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the narrative was so pervasive in mountaineering that women were physically incapable of doing this. Right? They couldn't carry the heavy loads. They didn't have the emotional strength to handle, you know, the hardships that were going to be thrown at them or the savage elements on mountains. And everyone knew this was such a popular narrative that their periods made them weaker and prone to hysteria on a monthly basis, right? So this is what is pervading mountaineering and all athletics for the most part, right? Up until, I mean, probably like the 1980s even. So this is a really accepted narrative that women just physically can't do these things. And there are, I've got a few of these anecdotes in my book, these outrageous things that women used to have to deal with who wanted to break into mountaineering. So that idea that the slang that originated that an easy climb was dubbed an easy day for a lady, which was still used up until, you know, relatively recently, has fallen out of practice now, like it goes back to there was this great anecdote in the 1920s where these two women were climbing this insanely difficult route in the Alps. And it was a route where if the lead person who was leading the climb, placing protection on the top of the rope so that if you fell, that protection would catch you, the person who was leading this climb, anybody who had fallen from it, it didn't matter about the protection. It was notorious that anybody who had fallen on this climb died. And these two women were going for this route for the first time ever. And this group of men who are on the route gather to watch them. They navigate it successfully, which is incredible. The route in general, anyone navigating it successfully. And the day had not even ended before this famous French climber said, "A pity that that has been done because it used to be a very good climb," right? Like no self-respecting man will undertake it now. There is another absolutely outrageous incident in the late 1950s where an alpinist named Claude Kogan was leading the first female ascent of Cho Oyu, which is the world's sixth highest mountain in the Himalaya. And she did have male guides and Sherpas, but her entire team was female. She and a few of her expedition were swept away and killed by an avalanche at their high camp before they reached the summit. And a British reporter named Stephen Harper called it another sort of tick in the box that women were still the weaker sex when it came. I mean, they had no control over that, right? But they were still the weaker sex. Or one of my absolute favorite, ridiculously outrageous anecdotes was in 1961, which is only 9 years before this all-female Denali climb takes place, right? Just 9 years, not that long. 1961, this American climber named Irene Miller went to Makalu Base Camp in the Himalaya with her husband. She was a great climber, hoping to join Sir Edmund Hillary's expedition up that mountain. Hillary not only forbade her from the climb, another member of his expedition said to her, "You ought to be willing to sleep with all the men on the team if you want to be on this expedition," as in have sex with, let's be clear, even though she had gone to base camp with her husband. So this is what was going on for these women, what they were facing down.
This, as you mentioned, just 9 years before this 1970. So definitely these attitudes prevailed, right, at this point. Let's take a break. We'll come back and continue the story. Fascinating story. The book is 30 Below. We're talking with the author, Cassidy Randall. Talking about a group of female adventurers, their treacherous pioneering ascent of Denali in 1970. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with writer Cassidy Randall. Her new book is called 30 Below. That comes out on Tuesday, out and available, and a fascinating story. It's the story of a group of female adventurers and their treacherous pioneering ascent of Denali in 1970. By the way, I guess current news, Cassidy Randall, President Trump is wanting to revert the name back to Mount McKinley, right? I guess, I don't know, likely to happen, I guess, since he's decreed it. He's told the Interior Secretary to make that happen.
Yeah, it is in the works, and I have actually an op-ed coming out in the New York Times on this soon, that the thing about renaming the mountain is that, you know, for almost a century, it was called Mount McKinley. But even during that time, Alaskan climbers and a lot of Americans still called it by the name that it had been for millennia, which is Denali. And that is Koyukon Athabaskan for the Great One. That's what that means. And I think, you know, it's really rare that indigenous names persist in our mainstream vocabulary after colonialist renames. But with Denali, it had already been entwined with this pursuit that made it famous before that sort of nonsensical rename. Like President McKinley had never even been to Alaska, he had no connection to the mountain whatsoever. But the word Denali had already become synonymous in so many minds with this great and far wild and this elusive peak that took so many expeditions to get to the top of. So there was a lot of romance around it. And because of that, I think it had already embossed itself on our vocabulary. And so when President Obama officially restored the name Denali in 2015, he really was just restoring the long reach of the mountain's original name that had always persisted. So I think that regardless of these renaming sort of histrionics that we're seeing right now, It's already in our vocabulary, and Alaskans and climbers have already come forward in droves to confirm they'll continue calling it Denali.
So before we get to back to Grace Holman and her assembling her all-female team, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the difficulties and dangers of Denali. It's 20,000 feet, right? And this is one of those mountains where it's quite the adventure just to get to base camp, right? And that's 1967 expedition. This was kind of an extreme, but an example. 7 days that storm raged, 300-mile-an-hour winds, you know, killed those seven men. Tell me a little bit more about those dangers of Denali that Grace was determined to face.
Yes. Denali is, even though it's not one of the tallest peaks on Earth, it's one of the biggest. And so it rises from its base because it sits on the tundra, right? On a little plateau of only 2,000 feet and rises over 20,000 feet. That's 18,000 feet of elevation gain, which actually is 6,000 more feet than Everest gains from its base. And so climbers have to be on the mountain for a long period of time to be able to acclimate their bodies for that kind of altitude gain. And being on the mountain for that amount of time also subjects you to these wild weather patterns that happen on Denali. So Denali is the highest polar mountain, and it sits close to the coast. And both of those conditions mean that it is subject to these really fast weather changes, really strong storms, high winds. It's notorious for high winds. It's consistently absolutely freezing, no matter the season that you're climbing it at the top of the mountain. And it is a feat, essentially, especially at, you know, in the 1960s, 1970s, people were still climbing mountains siege style, which is very different than the light and fast alpinism that we see today. It meant that they were using these enormous snowshoes, right, that were 2 or 3 feet long, totally unwieldy, and these huge frame packs that were so heavy. All the gear was so heavy, but they were carrying all of these supplies to set up a succession of camps up the mountain. And so by the time on that first expedition where in 1967, where Grace was turned back halfway, she basically had already climbed the equivalent of 3 Denalis, just setting up all these camps and carrying this gear, right? So it was a physical undertaking, absolutely.
You told us before Grace Holman had failed twice or been sent back twice, altitude sickness. Before we get to there, tell me about altitude sickness. How does that manifest it? She'd suffer from this, we think, twice on Denali.
Yes, there are two kinds of altitude sickness. One affects the brain and one affects the lungs. And both of them show some of the early symptoms are, you know, dizziness, losing your appetite, losing your judgment, irritability. And that kind of altitude, that's the way the altitude affects everyone's bodies, right? When there's less oxygen in the air, our blood works harder to get oxygen to our brain. We just don't function the way that humans evolved to function, essentially. That's why on those big mountains, like in Everest, it's called the death zone. We cannot survive in really high elevations without oxygen. Our bodies just don't do that. And the way in advanced altitude sickness, the bodies start to react is when it impacts the brain, which is what Grace ended up suffering from. We often, when it gets to these advanced stages, we don't realize that we have deteriorated, and we also can't make as good of decisions. And so that leads to a really dangerous situation, right? Where you don't know that you're worse. You don't know that you have to go down. And a lot of climbers have died from altitude sickness.
So you told us Grace Holman has failed twice on Denali or been sent back twice. High stakes on this third attempt, right? Because as you mentioned, if she fails again, she may not be invited to go, you know, in these high peaks. So high stakes, what leads her to have this idea? Let's have all female team do this.
Yeah, there is a third stake that you and I didn't talk about yet. And it is this heartbreaking love story between Grace and Vin. And so her husband, Vin Holman, who was also a really well-respected, well-known Alaskan mountaineer. And after that 1967 expedition, Vin had been invited to Dalagiri 1 in the Himalaya to climb this peak, which is also widely known as one of the hardest peaks to climb, and by this route that had never been done. And the expedition leader asked Vin to help him put together some names of people who could help, who could be on this expedition. And Vin puts Grace forward. And Grace had so much experience. She had climbed mountains in several continents, high peaks. She had several solo first descents to her name. And again, she's a doctor, very valuable on an expedition. And the expedition leader said no. He wrote back and said that Grace had illusions of grandeur and light experience, even though she had more experience than a lot of the men who ended up on the team. So she is forced to stay back and she becomes pretty upset about it, obviously. Vin goes and Vin ends up dying in an avalanche on Dalagiri 1. And this is the love of her life, right? And she develops this really heavy survivor's guilt, thinking, what if I had been on that expedition? Would there have been different choices made where he wouldn't have died? He wouldn't have been in that spot. What if there were all women on an expedition? Would we make different choices? So she's sort of thinking about this, she's mulling it over. And then this letter arrives. I don't want to give away too much of the book, but this letter arrives from a climber named Arlene Bloom from California to Vin Holman. And it comes to Vin after he's died. Arlene doesn't know that he's died. And it's a request, sort of a follow-up of a correspondence where Arlene had been thinking about climbing Denali as well and putting together a team. And her team, which was made up of her and a couple of her male climbing partners, had fallen apart. She had been asking Vin for backup. And this was a time in the late 1960s, early 1970s on Denali. You needed the Alaska Rescue Group, which Vin was a part of, or another party on the mountain to essentially act as your rescue because the mountain is so high that no rescuers are just going to helicopter in at that point. Nobody's going to just come get you, right? You needed to have somebody who had the experience to come and get you. So Arlene had been corresponding with Vin. And Grace finds this letter in this pile of correspondence after Vin dies. And she replies to Arlene instead of Vin. And Grace says, I've been thinking about an all-female expedition. If you were interested, let me know. And that I think is a very fateful way that it came about that Grace was really had like the momentum to plan this climb.
Tell me about Arlene Bloom.
Yeah, so Arlene also so fascinating. And she was young at the time of this climb. She was in her early 20s and she had grown up in the Midwest, fell in love with mountain climbing when she moved out west for college to Reed College. And she had also just had some of the most absurd things told to her about being a female climber. One, she didn't really have very many, if any, female climbing companions at the time. She had been this expedition that she had planned with her advisor, because she's also a chemist, to go and study volcanic gases on some Mexican mountains. She had invited her on-again, off-again boyfriend, who had introduced her to mountains, to come on it. Her boyfriend ends up writing the grant to fund this. And then he writes her out of the grant after she invited him, saying that, he was worried that the foundation would think that they were on a honeymoon rather than doing real science. She was the one who had been barred from this expedition to a mountain in Afghanistan because the presence of women would be unpleasant in excretory situations. She also had been told that women were weak, and this really ridiculous one that this male guide had told her that women either aren't good climbers or they aren't real women. So she had just, come up against all these walls. And then just before she gets this letter from Grace, as her idea for climbing Denali had fallen apart, her two male climbing companions had decided they were joining this guided expedition instead up the mountain. And she thought, oh, well, maybe that's my ticket up Denali, right? I'll join this guided expedition. But the brochure for this expedition said in black and white, women will not be admitted on the climb unless they wanted to stay at base camp and cook for the men.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. So these six women chip on their shoulder, I would imagine, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
We're
Just
gonna
such
prove some
pride.
things here, yeah.
Yes.
So they ended up with a woman from New Zealand, another one from Australia. I guess the mountain climbing community is, somewhat small, especially females. That's how Grace found these women.
Yeah, so Grace and Arlene, Grace asks Arlene to be the deputy leader, and the two of them put together a list of women and really vet it. And part of the reason they, I mean, obviously they wanted to vet who had the skills to be on Denali with them. They wanted to be with people who knew what they were doing. The social cohesion was very important to them. They knew that whoever you're with for a month on a mountain in harsh conditions can really flay you raw, right? So you want to at least like who you're with. And they also knew that they probably would be subject to heightened scrutiny because they were an all-women's team. And because, you know, you think about any boundary breakers by default end up representing not just their own capability at what they're trying to do, but the capability of the entire demographic of which they're from, right? And so in that way, Grace and Arlene knew that they were representing all women on this climb, not just their own capability. And if they failed, it was just yet more proof that women didn't belong in the mountains. And so, you know, very carefully vetting this team of a very small pool of people, right? There just were not that many women who were mountaineers who could take a month off, who weren't, you know, didn't have small children, all of this. And the way that they all find each other ends up being quite fateful, actually, which is also some of the fun storytelling in the book.
The Margaret Young, tell me about Margaret Young.
I
She's
think Margaret.
fascinating.
Yeah, what an eccentric. Oh my goodness. So she was the only woman at this climbing meeting that Arlene had gone to in before as they were planning the Denali climb. Arlene went to this meeting and stood up at the end of it and said, "I'm looking for women to join me on this climb to Denali." And basically everybody in the room scoffs at her. All these men are like, "There's no way women can't do that." I mean, it's amazing to me that people literally thought this was impossible. Nobody even knew if it could be done. And there was one person in that room who did not scoff at it. And it was this woman, Margaret Young, who was a climber in the Bay Area. Arlene was in Berkeley at this time doing a PhD, so she's in the Bay Area as well. And Margaret Young was, she was a member of the Forbes family, but you would never know that she was astronomically wealthy. The first time Arlene walked into her house, it looked like a science laboratory meets a pack rat's hoard, basically. So she was just absolutely brilliant. Margaret Young was a physicist. She was a pilot. She learned to fly her own Cessna so that she could take herself to these remote climbs. She installed skis on it herself so she could land it on glaciers. She became a mechanic so that she could fix her plane herself. I mean, talk about a woman navigating a man's world in all these different arenas. And she just apparently did not give two clicks what anyone cared about her whatsoever. She just did whatever she wanted and she did it unapologetically.
I don't want to give away too much of the book, but I do want to have you talk a little bit about as they're climbing this all-female team, there's a men's team climbing at the same time, and these folks are not supportive, I guess you could. They're critical, right?
Right. Yeah. So going back to this idea that you were required at that time to have what was called backup on Denali, which meant that you had to have another team say that they would help you out climbing somewhere near you on the mountain if something went wrong. And so this climber from Seattle reaches out to Grace and says, "Hey, you know, I got your name from, you know, again, the small climbing community. I know you're part of the Alaska Rescue Group. You've been on Denali. And I hear you might be putting together an expedition. My team of men will be on at the same time. Could we be backup for each other?" He spells her name wrong in that first correspondence, which is interesting. She doesn't mention that. She just politely spells her name correctly as she replies. And she replies, "Yeah, that would be great, assuming your team is capable. My team is all very capable women." And he writes back to her, and remember, he was asking for her help. He writes back to her, "A certain amount of hilarity was generated at our meeting at the thought of an all-women's expedition. Like, that's ridiculous." And unfortunately, her reply to that is unrecorded. And Grace was a very honest and direct woman, and I would have loved to have seen what her reply to that was. But so they, the Seattle team, Grace had gone to some pains to be sure that their start dates were a little different, that the Seattle team would be a little further ahead because she knew that were they climbing close to each other by default, a lot of people would say, "Well, the men broke the trail for you," or "The men helped you probably do all these things." So she was like, "Well, good, let's make sure they're a little further apart." she ends up horrified that because of some storms, the men haven't been able to start on their start date. And when the women are flown into Denali base camp, that the Seattle men's team is still there. And she's like, oh God, great. And it ends up being that these men, I think there's a couple different anecdotes about the way that they were sort of questioning all of Grace's leadership and her ideas. And they asked Arlene if she could even tie him any knots and all of this. But it ends up being that these men come to develop this respect for these women who, without even trying, had just paced them on the mountain. And that ends up being very fateful later on in the book when there's this huge crisis where the women have done all they can and they end up needing a little help, or at least one of them is going to die.
Let's take another break. Come back with more with Cassidy Randall. The new book is 30 Below. It tells the story of a group of female adventurers in the treacherous pioneering ascent of Denali in 1970. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Cassidy Randall, author of the new book, 30 Below, and that is out on Tuesday. Quite the adventure, well worth the read. Cassidy Randall, this is 1970, which is, you know, pretty recent, but not. All female ascent, you know, should have been big news. I guess it probably was at the time, but it's largely been forgotten until this book. Why do you think?
Yeah, I think there are a couple different reasons for that. One is the timing of when it unfolded. So this was 2 months before the Women's Strike for Equality in August of 1970, where all these women marched down Fifth Avenue and put second wave feminism on the map. It was the big event that really brought second wave feminism into people's minds. And I think had this climb unfolded after that, you know, sort of in what we could call the fevered days of this, the momentum of this new movement, where people were hungry for this idea of, supporters were anyway, were hungry for this idea of lone heroines and male dominated spheres, I wonder if the climb might have received a little more coverage. But there also, I think, was still this pervasive narrative in some parts of the world, like you and I talked about earlier, that if a woman had achieved a climb or a summit without men's help, that it was deemed too easy to ever do again. And was there something along the lines of, well, this is Denali and there's still so much there and we don't want that to be taken off, you know, the roster for the rest of us to climb. So there could be a little of that. I also think that what's really interesting is 2 years after that climb, Arlene Bloom read in the paper about the first all-female ascent on Denali. And it was a Japanese women's team. And she was like, wait a second. I mean, Bay Area news and Anchorage and Alaska news had covered it. And some New Zealand news had covered, you know, the 1970 climb. No national news covered it. She reads about this in the LA Times, about this 1972 first all-female ascent of Denali. And what was really interesting about it was this group of five Japanese women, three of them had died. And so they had supposedly reached the summit and then been killed on the way down. And there was only three short paragraphs and it only talked about the women who died and it never mentioned the two survivors. And I think that we also were still in this era where the narratives that serve to prop up the popular narrative are the ones that gain the most steam, right? And so these stories of failure, of the fact that women still couldn't do this, perhaps had a little more traction than, look what just happened, women could do this. But all speculation.
This team, led by Grace Holman, called themselves the Denali Damsels, which I guess you're really leaning into this. This idea, right? All female. The danger is, you know, damsels in distress. Why did they call themselves the Denali Damsels?
Yeah, I think they really liked the irony of it. There actually is in the correspondence when Margaret Young comes up with this name. And they officially called themselves on their application to the park and all of their stationery where they were asking for sponsorships. They called themselves the International McKinley Women's Team. And then in just cursive, it would say Denali Damsel, so on the bottom. And that Margaret Young had come up with this on a climb. And when Arlene wrote to Grace about it, Grace wrote back, I just laughed out loud. That is amazing. Let's do that. Because Arlene, all of them, I think, love the irony of it, right? That it would conjure this image that they were just walking up the mountain, you know, in their like skirts with parasols in hand. That it actually is one of the hardest mountains in the world to climb. And they just thought it was hilarious, basically.
I want to ask you about your research. This must have been fascinating. I understand it was your publisher or somebody sent you a National Park Service, a little paragraph or something, saying, hey, this might make a good story. And then you had to embark and find the story. What kinds of things did you find?
Oh, that was such an adventure in itself. Yeah, so my agent actually had sent me a link to this National Park Service blog post that was the 50th anniversary of this climb. And I had been reporting on women's issues in, you know, the outdoors adventure and elsewhere for some years before and had never heard of this and thought, why not? And it's for some of these reasons we talked about. And there was a link at the bottom of this blog post to Arlene Bloom's website, where she has written three chapters about the Denali climb in her memoir that's called Breaking Trail. And my early research led me to that website, but also to Grace Homan's archives in the University of Anchorage, University of Alaska in Anchorage. And Grace and Vin have this treasure trove of correspondence and writings. Grace was also a writer. She was the Alaska editor for the American Alpine Journal. She was a beautiful writer. And their love story and just this history of Grace's that I thought was so fascinating. And it led me to Margaret Clark's writings, who is the Kiwi, the New Zealand climber, also a phenomenal writer. And she wrote this three-part feature series for the Christchurch Press on this climb. And it also led me to the fact that Arlene and Margaret were still alive to get to talk about this and tell their sides of the story. So all of this was just an adventure in putting together the correspondence that still exists. Arlene had archived a lot of her life at the Stanford University. And there were still so many letters about that, all these articles, other people who had written about climbing in that era, other people who had climbed with these women, even though, you know, a lot of these women had already died. But it made me wonder and think about if somebody were trying to write this kind of book about us today, where would they find all this, right? Like, we only send emails and texts and we don't save things like this. Like, what a gift to have all of this historical archives.
I've wondered about that as well. That's just parenthetically what, 30 years from now, 50 years from now, for our adventures, whoever our adventures are, right? What's going to happen?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know. Hopefully somebody's archiving emails, I guess.
I know. Should we print this out?
Maybe we should print them out. Yeah. by the way, before we close, I just have to, just a little anecdote really struck me. At a certain point, Grace Homan, she marries a wealthy man. He takes her to Curaçao. And their highest point is about 1,000 feet. this pitiful little hill. She goes and climbs it anyway. I guess it's in the blood.
Yes, totally. Yeah. Which is funny. So Grace was also untraditional. This is why I loved writing this book. Side note, because all of these women were very complex and they were surprising, right? In this era where women were only allowed to play certain roles, right? Lone heroine, damsel in distress, princess, witch. And they all were so complex. And this was Grace's second husband after her first had been shot in combat, right? And he was another doctor, takes her to Curaçao with her two daughters who have come to live with her by then. And yeah, she climbs the one mountain, ends up being bored and goes back to Syracuse and she ends up divorcing the second husband.
So finally, just about a minute left. What do you most want people to know about the Denali Damsels?
Oh man, I think read the book for this incredible first that nobody has heard of. And this idea, and not just because it's about, you know, a first for women, but because it's a good story. Like, it is an improbable survival story. And I wrote it, I personally don't like reading dry nonfiction. And so I wrote this much more as if you were reading fiction, as if it were plot and character driven. And it has this insane climax moment where it just is a good adventure. So I want people to, you know, take this story as an incredible first, but also a really fun read.
Well, the book is out on Tuesday. Well worth the read. 30 Below is the name of the book. We've been talking with the author, Cassidy Randall. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
It's One Sky, Many Cultures. Skywatcher Leo T here. As we take the little Skywatcher landship around the curve of the Earth to Capitol Reef, Boulder, and Escalante in 50 to 60 degree weather, we get to experience blue skies, white clouds of different shapes and textures, ravens and crows to greet me on my way, as they often do in central and southern Utah. When in Torrey, a friend mentioned the sea of rainbows on the moon to ignite the magic of our closest neighbor. Thanks, Larry. And I motor on the next day over the pines and aspen to Boulder and Escalante, see the Kaparowitz Plateau, and you drop back a few million years on this drive around the curve past Henryville, Cannonville, Kodachrome State Parks in there, and Tropic, and on up to Bryce Canyon, where I walked and photographed the glowing amphitheater from the rim above in the late afternoon, say 4:30-ish, and the sunlight angle was going through the top of the hoodoos and lighting them up on a surreal scale. And from an informative placard right here, I learned that in Paiute oral tradition, long before other Indians, the legend people inhabited the region for hundreds of years, and the Paiute inhabited this area hundreds of years before the arrival of the European Americans. The sacred oral tradition states that the hoodoos here at the Bryce are ancient legend people turned to stone as a punishment for bad deeds. It is the custom of the Paiutes to tell these stories only during winter season. Spring, summer, and fall are for hunting, gathering, and storing food. There are some marvelous photos that I'll post on the Skywatcher Facebook page when I can get a bit more time. As it is, I'm using the Wi-Fi at the Thunderbird Lodge where I am. I'm a little bit past checkout time. They're giving me a little bit extra time here to put this together. Last night, though, after Bryce, I drove over to Red Canyon, and if you've ever been there, well, you're hiking amongst the ponderosa and deeper pink-orange rocks with a few birds, and then went on the highway after this past Orderville, where Maynard Dixon had his painting studio and where there's still a museum to check out, and on to Mount Carmel Junction, the junction with Highway 9 to Zion National Park or Highway 89 to Kanab. As I pulled in here last night, I watched the pink paintbrush clouds announce the coming deep dusk and the night. Later, as I took a rare dip and luxuriously in a hot tub, I watched Mars poke out near the twinkly magical Carstable, and tonight I hope to see even more night magic with some shooting stars and the twirly trails of stars and planets above. And coming in March, Bella Luna, the moon, will be staging some close encounters with bright stars and planets. Mercury will even make its best appearance in the evening sky. In the evening twilight on March 1st, Venus stands to the upper right of the moon and Mercury will be below them. It is low on the horizon, looks like a star. You'll need a clear view to spot it. And on the 5th, Jupiter is to the left of the moon with orangish Aldebaran, the brightest star of Taurus, just below, so look for all those little twinklies in Taurus too. Mars is close to the right of the moon at nightfall, and the Gemini twins to the left of the moon on the 8th. So keep looking up. Looking in, look around at the sky all around you and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.